crisis which has occupied us in two sections over quite a number of months, we come now this evening to the beginning of that section of Genesis which leads us into the closing chapters of the book. You would perhaps recognize that if you had been here from the beginning of our study by the phrase in the beginning of chapter 37. Verse 2 begins, "This is the account of Jacob." Now we have found that the book of Genesis really consists of 10 books of uneven length, which all begin with that same phrase. We came across it first of all right back in Genesis chapter 2. This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created. And then you get that particular chapter of the story. And then later on we discover this is the written account in chapter 5 of Adam's line. And so it goes on until we come to this tense occurrence of that same phrase, which marks out the fact that we are here in the last passage, the last episode in the drama of the book of Genesis. And it is, this is the account of Jacob. But of course you will know that really these phrases introduce us to the family and descendants of the person they name. So here, very specially, we are coming to the part of Genesis which focuses on one of Jacob's descendants, his 11th and favorite son, Joseph. And Joseph, the son of his old age, comes onto the center of the stage for the rest of the account in the book of Genesis and really dominates chapters 37 to 50. He is obviously, therefore, a figure of great importance. Joseph's history is, of course, fascinating just as a story. It is the stuff of which great drama is made. The spoiled boy, hated by his jealous brothers, ultimately sold by them into slavery, but unknown to them, raised to a place of responsibility in the land into which they sold him, the land of Egypt, and given a place of some status in society as the steward of the house of Potiphar. Then again, cast by cruel injustice into prison. And from prison again taken up. Talk about the changing scenes of life. Joseph knew them all. And from prison he's taken up and again brought almost in one astonishing step from prisoner to the prime minister's desk in Egypt. And he becomes the most powerful man in the land. And then the great denouement at the end, when Joseph finds his brothers appearing before him, and ultimately he reveals himself to them. "I am Joseph," he says. "Is my father still alive?" Collapse of these brothers, who doubtless imagined that their days were seriously numbered. But Joseph's story is the story that so many of us have known as one of the most dramatic stories in the whole of the Bible. But its main interest and significance for us lies, I think, in two areas. And these are the two areas in which I want to concentrate, the second more indeed than the first. The first of these two areas is in the remarkable evidence that this story of Joseph gives us of God's sovereign control over the whole of history. All through the book of Genesis, in one way or another, you can see this, as indeed throughout the whole of the Bible, but nowhere more clearly than here in the story of Joseph. God's purpose, you see, as he is making, drawing, and calling out a people for himself, his purpose is ultimately to make them the people from whom the Messiah will come. And so his plan is to prosper them, to enlarge and multiply them, to make of them, as he promised to Abraham, a great nation. Now, the best possible place to do that in the ancient world would have been in the land of Egypt, which bore a similar relation to the world of that day as the Roman Empire bore to first century culture in the ancient world. And the whole of Egyptian civilization was, of course, rich in every possible sense. And so God is preparing to enrich and enlarge and bless his people even through days of famine and difficulty in other areas. And he begins to prepare the man of his choosing and makes him prime minister of that very country in order that there the people of God may flourish and prosper. And Joseph himself recognizes that it is so. In chapter 45 of Genesis, if you look over in verse 5, when his brothers have finally come face to face with him, he says, "Now do not be distressed, and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." Verse 7, "God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God." So what Joseph sees is the hand of God in history, taking him up and using him as part of his purpose to take forward his gracious plan to bring a Redeemer out of his own people into the world. And even through the evil intentions of men, Jacob sees the sovereign purpose of God, which is a purpose for good. And so in the 50th chapter of Genesis, near the very end of the book, Joseph says to his brothers, "Don't be afraid," in verse 19, Genesis 50, 19, "Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." Now, do you see how Joseph has this vision of God's sovereign purpose in history? And he sees it not only hitherto, he sees it henceforth in the future. In the same 50th chapter in verse 24, he said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but my death and my departure will never frustrate the purpose of God. God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place." Do you see his confidence in God's sovereignty? He says, "I'm going to be buried here in Egypt, but the day will come, because God has a purpose for his people, when you will be taken up out of the land of Egypt, back into the land of Canaan, and these bones of mine you will carry up into the land of Canaan as a testimony that the living God is a sovereign God, and he is marching on through history to the accomplishment of his perfect will." And if you read on into the book of Exodus in chapter 13, the glorious thing is that when Moses is leading the people of God in the Exodus out of the land of Egypt, one of the primary things we are told that Moses did, he took the bones of Joseph and carried them into the land of Canaan. And the moldering bones of the dead patriarch were a living testimony to the sovereign power of a God who finishes what he begins, who does what he has planned, and who performs his perfect will, come what may. Now that's the confidence the Bible gives us, my dear friends, in God in relation to history. He is marching on towards the consummation of his purposes. Men may resist him, but ultimately God will have his way. And history is moving towards the consummation of his plan. And Joseph is an evidence of that. So the epistle to the Hebrews tells us in Hebrews 11:22, by faith, Joseph. Now what's Joseph's faith distinguished for? By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instruction about his bones. In other words, he had confidence in God and in his sovereign purpose in history. That's a confidence that you and I greatly need to have in this mad and crazy world, with so much evil rampant in it, with so much in it that defies analysis or explanation, to know that there is a God who has not abdicated his throne in heaven, who is fulfilling his purposes as year succeeds to year, and whose promises to his people, above all, will never, never fail. So give to the winds thy fears, as we sang. And that's how the Christian needs to live, with this central vision of the sovereignty of God in history. But perhaps the more important lesson for us this evening is not just the remarkable evidence of God's sovereignty in history, which runs right through this great story. It is in the remarkable example we have in Joseph's own life and character of a strong, consistent, effective man of God, of whom it is said so many times over, the Lord was with Joseph. So on the one hand, there is in these chapters the making of God's plan in history. But more personally, there is on the other hand the making of God's man in the hard school of life. And Joseph really did live in it. And it's that that may be peculiarly relevant to some of us this evening, who may know what it is to live in circumstances which are really the hard reality of the school of life, where we feel that we are being chiseled and molded and fashioned and often crushed in the providence of God. And Joseph is an example of the fact that God, who is sovereign over history, is also the King and Lord over the lives of his children when they are ready to trust everything to him with integrity, as Joseph was. I suppose for Joseph, life could scarcely have been harder. He was the spoiled son of a foolishly indulgent father. Chapter 37, verse 3, from which we read, "Now Israel," which was Jacob's new name, "Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he'd been born to him in his old age." You would have thought that Jacob would have learned from the sheer folly of having a favorite in the family from his own experience, wouldn't you? But he didn't. And Joseph thereby became the victim of his brother's spite and resentment deriving from his father's preferential treatment of him. Verse 4, when his brothers saw, this is chapter 37, when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. And so he was carried off to slavery in a foreign land. The last verse of chapter 37. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Then, just when his fortunes appeared to be changing, he was a trusted steward of Potiphar, a significant man in Egypt. He again suffers this injustice and lands in prison, and that's the story of chapter 39. There again, hope dawns for him in chapter 40. He interprets the dream of two fellow prisoners who happen to be servants of Pharaoh, and then asks them in chapter 40, verse 14, "When all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. Certainly," they said, "we will never forget you. Such a man as you, your name is engraved on our hearts." And they went into the presence of Pharaoh, and having used Joseph for their own purposes, they threw him aside. You ever know what it's like to have that happen to you? That's the hard school of life, you know. People use you and manipulate you and make you some kind of implement for their own purpose, and then they throw you aside. And Joseph stayed another 2 years in prison before finally he was brought out and brought to prominence in Pharaoh's household. Now, what I want to look at more closely for the rest of our time, as we see this man of God being molded and fashioned and sometimes crushed and well nigh broken, how Joseph faced and dealt with all the pressures of this schooling, and what it produced in him, because that's one of the key lessons of Joseph's life. I think it's important for us to notice, first of all, that Joseph is introduced to us in chapter 37 as a young man who has real personality problems. Some of them, I have little doubt, were hereditary, and others were derived from his upbringing. With a father like Jacob, he was almost certain to have some hereditary problems. Many of our children think that that applies in a general sense, but he certainly had problems being Jacob's son. He was born while Jacob was serving Laban, do you remember? And was involved in all the manipulation and deception which went on at that particular time in Jacob's life. He doubtless remembered the deep rivalry between his father Jacob and his uncle Esau, and the way his father trembled before the prospect of Esau coming to him and facing him again. And then he discovered something of the dominant ambitions of his father's life and the way he was prepared to use people for his own ends. And just as Jacob's mother had spoiled Jacob, Joseph found that Jacob was setting about spoiling him. Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, and he made him a richly ornamented robe for him. That robe, as I was saying, seems to have been most probably a robe that had long sleeves instead of no sleeves, because the robe with no sleeves meant that the man worked, you see. He was getting about the general business that a young man would do in the fields, but Joseph was precluded from that because of this robe, which was a mark of superiority and distinction. The top people wore this kind of garment, not the workers. And Joseph not only received it from his father, but paraded around in it. It seems in so many ways that Joseph was a fairly obnoxious kind of boy as a teenager. I never read the story, but think that he was probably in my class at school. We had a boy just like Joseph, who had a very rough time, not because of the reasons he thought, but because he was just particularly obnoxious like Joseph. He was a talebearer, Joseph. Do you notice this? In chapter 37, at the end of verse 2, he brought their father a bad report about them. So that Joseph used to go out and, as it were, spy on his brothers, then go back to his father and say, "Do you know what my brothers were doing today?" He was a talebearer. And he was not only his father's favorite son, but seemed to try to press this upon others. His dreams, as we may find in subsequent occasions, were dreams that most probably God gave to him, because these very brothers who said to him, "Will we bow down before you?" found themselves in the land of Egypt doing exactly what horrified them. They bowed down in the presence of Joseph when he was the prime minister of Egypt and craved mercy from him. But you know, he was a particularly insensitive lad to tell his dreams to his brothers. And when he had insulted them with one, to do it with another, and then to go to his father and mother and tell them too. I suppose that you might not actually approve of his brothers putting him down a well, but you can certainly understand why they did it, can't you? The significant thing is, of course, that from this point in Joseph's life, when all that he had thought was going to be his was suddenly snatched out of his hands, and he was cast into destitution and despair at the foot of the cistern, it was from that point that God took him up and began, out of the sheer harshness of his experience, to make him the kind of godly man that he became. And God's hand is on Joseph's life, and it's through adversity and suffering and long years of injustice and disappointment that he is shaped and molded into God's man for the hour. How did Joseph then cope with all these painful circumstances, which were the instrument of God in making him into the kind of man that he ultimately became? I think it's important for us to ask that. Because, you know, if God had left him alone, a spoiled boy in Shechem, he would never have been that figure of grandeur that he ultimately became. If he had been relieved of all the pressures and trials, if he had just been left to strut around as his father's favorite pet, then these qualities of character that we shall see in him would probably never have been there. I see two things that God produced in his character which were the key to making him, in some ways in a sense that his father never was, a prince with God and in the world. First, and you will see the link with what we were saying at the beginning, first a conviction that God's ways are perfect and good for his people. And secondly, a display of God-honoring integrity in every area of his life. First, a conviction that God's ways are perfect, as well as being sovereign, and that they are good for his children. Now, I don't think that was Joseph's immediate reaction as a boy of 17 when he was thrown into this well and then sold into slavery by his brothers and carted off into Egypt. But it was certainly the conviction which was formed in his character over the years by the sheer pressure of life and by the presence of God in every situation through which he passed. In chapter 39, for example, which is probably the nadir of Joseph's life, do you notice how again and again the vital thing is this, that the Lord was with Joseph. That is, that God's hand was on the man's life, that at every stage of every apparent disaster that overtook him, God's hand was upon him. Verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered and lived in the house of his Egyptian master. Then in verse 3, when his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. But then, even when he was in prison, verse 20, halfway through, but while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those who were held in the prison, and he made him responsible for all that was done there. Verse 23, the warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Now there is the vital thing, you see. Joseph experienced the reality of that at every stage in his life. The Lord was with him. And to Joseph, increasingly, that became the thing that really mattered. And so he was able to say to his brothers, in retrospect, looking back down through his history, you meant it for evil, he says, I recognize that. Your purposes were vicious and cruel and destructive. But I tell you what, he said. The vital thing is that as for God, his ways with me have been perfect. Now the man had gone through trials that leave most of our difficulties looking like minor inconveniences. But he said, the Lord meant it for good. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul voiced exactly the same assurance. All things, he says, work together for good to those who love God. And even the vicious cruelty of his brothers, even the injustice that he suffered in the prison at the hands of Potiphar's wife, even the long years of being forgotten and abandoned by those that he had trusted, the anguish that Joseph knew, the loss of everything that he had cherished, it was all part of God's perfect purpose to weave something in his life for his glory. My dear friends, are you able to look at all your adversity in that light? Are you able to see the difficulties and injustices and burdens and problems and anguish that being exposed to the harsh realities of life brings? Are you able to see them in that light and to say all things, not just some things, not just the nice and pleasant things or the things I can understand or work out, but all things are working together for good to those who love God? Now that's what Joseph's testimony was. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That's a conviction that clearly lay at the heart of Joseph's life. And I want to say to you this evening, that sweetens life and it sweetens personalities in a way that few other things do. There are people who have sour, bitter personalities because they have never really rested their soul and anchored their mind on this truth that everything works together for good to those who love God. And I tell you, if in the midst of every kind of trial you take it up and fit it in to that conviction, you will find that it sweetens personality and sweetens life. There's a glorious hymn in the book, "All My Ingenuities Were Unable to Find a Meter in the Book That Fitted It." And the tune, even with our own ingenuity, we couldn't sing. But when you go home tonight, you ought to look up hymn 763 in this book. "Whate'er my God ordains is right, holy his will abideth. Whate'er my God ordains is right. He never will deceive me. He leads me by the proper path. I know he will not leave me. I take content what he hath sent. His hand can turn my griefs away, and patiently I wait his day. Whate'er my God ordains is right. Here shall my stand be taken." That's the first thing about Joseph. A conviction that God's ways are perfect as well as sovereign, and they are good for his people. Here's the second thing. It's a display of God honoring integrity in every area of life. And that's the second way in which he met all the outrageous things that happened to him in his young life. Because Joseph, when he was prime minister of Egypt, was probably only a man turned 30. The first place that he had to display this integrity was in his own personal life and in his own personal relationships. Chapter 39 tells that pretty unsavory story of how Potiphar, who was his master, set him over everything that he had in his home and trusted him, forgot about everything, we read. He thought about nothing. Rather significantly, you'll see it in chapter 39, except his food. Chapter 39, verse 6. "So he left in Joseph's care everything he had, with Joseph in charge. He did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate." Something of a gastronome, I would guess, was Potiphar. But he left everything to Joseph because he could trust him, you see. A man of integrity. And he found him a trustworthy man. And that's a glorious thing in a secular society. Is it not? That people know your reputation. You're absolutely trustworthy through and through. Your word is your bond. And nobody never needs to ask, does he mean what he say? Can we leave him with the cash? Potiphar thought of nothing except his stomach while Joseph was his steward. And he lived with integrity towards his master. And then his master's wife sought to seduce him, and he was subjected to this particular temptation of which you can read here. And that integrity towards his master and towards his God caused him to refuse to be compromised in this area. Notice that in verse 9, when Potiphar's wife has approached him, he says, "No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" Now, do you see the twofold concern for absolute integrity in Joseph's life? Integrity towards his master who trusted him, and integrity towards God, who was his ultimate master. And that integrity led Joseph to flee from the house, as it should lead us to flee from that kind of temptation. And in the aftermath of it, he discovered that hell has no fury like a woman scorned. And Joseph bore injustice as Potiphar's wife slandered his character and held on to his coat, and then cried out first to the other servants and then to Potiphar that this Joseph had sought to take advantage of her. So Joseph bore injustice in prison, and he bore it with integrity. And when he is in the prison, he reveals the same integrity. You look over to chapter 40 and verse 8, you'll discover that he identifies himself in that prison as God's man. And he does it in so many ways from this point onwards. Chapter 40, verse 8, "We both had dreams," they answered. "There is no one to interpret them." Then Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" And in the next prison that he was in, or the next occasion that he was still in the same prison, rather, and 2 years later, in chapter 41, verse 16, he identifies himself again as God's man. "I cannot do it," Joseph replied to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh wanted an interpretation of his dream. "But God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires." And in verse 25 of that chapter, Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh." And in verse 28, "It is just as I said to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do." And in verse 32 of the chapter, he says, "The reason the dream was given to Pharaoh in two forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon." Now notice this man's absolute integrity in his own testimony, you see. He's not one man one place and another man another place. That's the great temptation in the modern world, is it not? Where you live and work. To be one man one place and another man another place. In the presence of the pagan Pharaoh, the thing would have been to hide his light under a bushel. But the absolute integrity that God was working out in the school of suffering in this man's life made him say, "The living God will tell you." May I ask every single one of you here this evening, have you that integrity in relation to other people wherever you are? Are you ready to be known as God's man, God's woman? In business, in your profession, in the society that you live in the social company that you keep, wherever you are in all your relationships, have you this godly integrity that refuses to dissemble and to be one man here and another man there? quality of character God was creating in Joseph. And you see, it was appreciated and recognized. It was strength of character that ultimately took him to the place of prime minister of all Egypt. And Pharaoh sees where this quality comes from. Do you notice in verse 37 of chapter 41, the plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials, so Pharaoh asked them, "Can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Joseph publicly names his sons to declare the foundation of his life at the end of that chapter. Beautiful thing Joseph does. Have you noticed this in verse 50, 51? Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, "It is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household." The second son he named Ephraim and said, "It is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering." What a testimony for a man to have. So Joseph grew. He grew in stature. He grew in grace. He grew in absolute burning integrity of life. And it's all because he learned confidence in God. See, the reason that we do not display the same quality of integrity that Joseph had is that we do not have absolute confidence in God as Joseph did. He believed God's ways were wisest. He believed God's timing was best. And above all, perhaps he believed that God's grace was sufficient. Now we'll come back to Joseph. But let me ask you this evening, what are you doing with the circumstances into which God has pitched you in these days? The pressures and difficulties, the hard realities of life. Are you allowing them to mold you into the kind of man or woman who will become, in the truest and greatest sense, a prince with God? May God find in these days many of us who will look at Joseph in the fullness of his godly maturity and say, "Lord, make me like that." Let's pray together. Father, we thank you for your holy word and for its counsels. Thank you for the way that you patiently wrought in the life of such a man as Joseph and took him so unpromising and made him a man molded to your glory. We are encouraged to look to you to do that very thing for us, for the glory and praise of our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.